team's lack of live-fire experience with Zingers to be anything to worry about. That's where Smythe's greater experience and training showed, against my own. He considered anything that could go wrong. I'd only thought of things likely to go wrong. That was one difference with elite soldiers. They left almost nothing to chance. Phase 2. Didn't work exactly as I expected. Again, the Kristang waited until there was clear weather over both their base and our area, a delay of 2 days. We watched the dropship being loaded, taken off, and cruising toward us. The dropship didn't bother to overfly the crash site. They must have thought they had plenty of intel from the satellites. From listening in to the dropship pilots' communications with the scavenger leaders back at the base, we knew the leaders were extremely anxious not to take any risks with their last functional aircraft. They ordered the pilot to land in an open area and to stay away from narrow canyons. Instead of overflying the Luzzard crash site, the dropship came straight in from the southwest. My services as a spotter for the Zinger teams were not needed because the dropship flew directly over a site we thought was a likely place for the Kristang to land. The British SAS had a Zinger team there. They hit the dropship as it flared to go into hover mode. The pair of Zingers streaked up in the blink of an eye and both hit the dropship's starboard engine pod. If that dropship had been at higher altitude, it might have had a chance to recover. It didn't. It flipped over and hit the ground hard, almost nose first, into a big boulder on the canyon floor. The force of the impact pancaked the front quarter of the dropship like an accordion. No way anyone inside had survived the crash. Smythe held his alpha teams, the people in armored suits, back for 10 minutes to be sure no angry Kristang came out of the wreck, and to be sure the whole thing didn't explode on us. I didn't waste any time. As soon as the dropship hit, I left the Zinger team on the hilltop and ran to the new crash site. It was downhill almost all the way. It still took me over an hour to get there. That was frustrating, because from the hilltop I'd been able to see the crash dropship, and it took me freaking forever to get to it. In defense of my fitness level, Newark's gravity had me weighing 14% more than Earth normal, and the low oxygen level had me breathing hard simply when walking around. While running relatively easily down a gentle slope, I checked in with Skippy. Hey, Skippy, how are your Oscar-winning special effects going?
Oh, Joe, this is truly an epic Hollywood production. It has chills, thrills, shocking surprises, and pulse-pounding plot twists that leave the audience gasping. I laughed. I cried. It's the feel-good movie of the year.
Well, unless you're the scavenger Kristang here, in which case it's the feel-bad movie of the year.
Maybe the century.
Uh-huh. They buy in it, then? Hook, line, and sinker. I believe that is the correct expression. Yes, they believe everything they see and hear through the satellite feed. There is no reason for them to doubt the data. What the scavenger leaders saw through the manipulated satellite feed was their dropship getting shot down by a pair of Zingers. Skippy hadn't edited that part at all. This time we wanted the scavengers seeing their aircraft shot down with Kristang portable anti-aircraft missiles. After the dropship hit the ground, Skippy had faked the imagery. The scavengers didn't see humans approach the scavengers' crashed dropship. Instead, they saw Kristang on the ground take the camouflage netting off a concealed dropship, then get aboard that dropship, fly over to the Elder Power Tap, pick it up, and fly into orbit. The mysterious second group of Kristang, having taken the big prize, then rendezvoused with a ship in orbit, a ship that lowered its stealth field long enough to take the dropship aboard. The ship then climbed out of orbit, out to safe jump range, and when this phantom ship was on the other side of the planet from the scavenger base, it jumped away. The satellite data feed included the telltale gamma-ray burst of a starship jumping. It was all, Skippy assured us, and we hoped, very convincing. The remaining scavengers had to be hopping mad by now. Not only did they now not have any functional aircraft, they had lost the priceless Elder Power Tap, lost it to a rival, unknown group of Kristang, a group that got away cleanly and was now on its way back to civilization with an Elder artifact that was worth more than many habitable planets. The scavengers were now effectively stuck at their base with whatever less valuable Elder trinkets they'd recovered, waiting to be picked up. If that had happened to me, I would sure be hopping mad. From Skippy tapping into their communications, he reported the scavenger leaders were swearing vengeance, arguing and fighting amongst themselves, and generally expending a whole lot of energy uselessly. Phase 2, I judged, was a complete success.
To avoid utter humiliation at my lack of fitness, I stopped for a minute in a stream bed near the crashed dropship, hidden from the Spec Ops team's view, and sucked in air until my pulse stopped racing. The commander showing up, collapsing on the ground and puking after what should have been an easy downhill run, was something I very much wanted to avoid. When my hands stopped shaking, I stepped out of the stream bed and jogged slowly toward the smashed dropship. 2 dozen or more people were standing around it, rifles slung over shoulders. The guys in armor suits had their helmets off. They had gotten a side door open easily. The door frame wasn't even warped in the crash. Kristang built their ships tough, that's for sure. There were 4 Kristang bodies laying on the wet grass outside their crashed ship. 3 of the bodies were broken and mangled. 1 appeared to merely be asleep. I looked away, uncomfortable that these Kristang had died because of a sneak attack on my orders. Captain Smythe saw me coming and saluted.
"Colonel, you need to see this. We have a surprise. We're clear here. The Kristang are all dead."
When we shot down the Luzzard, I had stayed away from the crashed ship because it brought back too many bad memories. Memories of the 2 whales my team had shot down on Paradise. Memories of the chicken that the Kristang had deliberately crashed there because the human pilot refused to fire a missile at a school full of children. I had those memories inside my head. They haunted me every day. I didn't need a reminder. That's why I had remained away from the crashed Luzzard. Now, I couldn't avoid seeing the dropship we had shot down, and Smythe expected me to go inside it. Steeling myself inwardly, I nodded silently to Smythe and grabbed the doorframe with 2 hands to pull myself up and into the dropship. Inside was less of a shambles than I expected. There was some blood, and debris had been thrown around in the violence of the crash. When I turned to look toward the rear, I got a surprise.
"What in the hell is this?" I asked.
The back 2/3 of the dropship were stuffed with some sort of thing. It looked like a big, rounded RV, a long tube, specially designed to fit into a dropship. It barely cleared the walls and ceiling. Straps held it securely in place.
"We think it's a vehicle of some kind, sort of a caravan," Smythe explained. "What you Americans call a recreational vehicle."
Why in the hell had the Kristang brought an RV with them to Newark?
We hadn't seen them loading the RV into the dropship at the base. It must have already been on the ship. It seemed like an awful lot of weight to carry, unless they really needed it. Or maybe they did really need it. An RV would be useful for driving up the canyon to recover items from the Luzzard crash site and to get the precious Elder power tap. For use on Newark, the RV would need to be capable of operating over very rough, unimproved terrain. From satellite images, we hadn't seen evidence that the Kristang had built roads anywhere, not even around the widely scattered Elder Starship crash site. Although having an RV would have been a great help in exploring rather than walking, or having to fly everywhere.
"How does it move? I don't see any wheels."
Skippy sighed into my Z-phone earpiece.
"So impatient, you monkey. You can't see the treads because they're retracted to fit inside the dropship. You will need to get the dropship mostly upright, remove the cargo straps from the RV and lower the rear ramp. Then I'll get it started and drive it out for you."
The dropship was huge, almost the size of a 737 airliner. It was laying on its side.
"How are we supposed to get it upright? This thing must weigh a couple tons."
"It does. You can rig up cables, and I really shouldn't have to remind you, dum-dums, you have powered armor suits with you, duh."
Duh was right. I hadn't thought about the armor.
Powered armor did help. We needed to tell people to go slowly and be careful, as they almost used too much force and flipped the dropship over on its other side instead of on its bottom. We gave the dropship a good 10 minutes to settle on its bottom. I didn't want to risk anyone going inside until we were sure its structure wasn't going to collapse on us. When I gave the go-ahead, 2 soldiers went in the side door, and after a few minutes the rear ramp cracked open, lowered about halfway, and then got jammed in that position. It was amazing the thing worked at all, I suppose. After screwing with it for almost an hour, after which it was still stuck 2/3 closed, we gave up and cut through the lift mechanisms on each side. With the supports cut through, the ramp crashed down and bounced on the ground, bent a bit, but functional. Next, the team released the straps and latches that held the RV in place. Once freed, it shifted to slide against the port side of the dropship.
All right, Skippy, let's see you drive that RV out of there.
There was a whining sound of electric motors. Skippy had to wiggle it, with a lot of scraping and some tearing sounds, as it slowly extracted itself from the dropship's distorted fuselage. The RV was surprisingly intact. Dents and scrapes here and there. Nothing that prevented it from running properly. Out of the dropship, we could see its true size. It was as big as a city bus, or a really large RV. What it ran on was interesting. It had wheels, but wheels made of treads like a tank. The treads could be adjusted to be round for speed over good terrain, or oval-shaped for crawling along like a tractor. Skippy said the part of the treads that stuck out for traction could be retracted or extended for use in thick mud. Along each side were inflatable pontoons, so the RV could cross rivers, swamps, or even lakes. There were water jets built into each pontoon for propulsion and water. "Damn, Skippy, this is a hell of a vehicle," I had to admit.
"Everything you need for a fun-filled family vacation, Colonel Joe."
"Yeah, except for a couple sullen teenagers and a solid week of rain. And bugs. That's what I recall of many fun-filled vacations in my family."
"Any chance we can drive this thing all the way to the scavenger's base?"
"Unfortunately, no. The power cells only hold enough charge to get you about 40% of the way there."
"Crap."
"Ah, hey. That's 40% of the way that we don't have to walk."
"Hey, pop the door open, will you? I want to see inside."
We were all eager to see inside our new RV. I went in last to give everyone a good look at our prize. It was well-worn and smelled funky. There were no frills on the inside. Two seats up front, then a dozen more seats that converted into bunk beds. No kitchen or other provision for cooking. No bathroom. I suppose the Kristang expected their crew to take care of those activities outside. In the back was a large, separate bay for cargo. Sort of a garage. It was empty. Rubbing my chin while looking around the Spartan RV interior, I asked, "We can fit, what, 12, 14 people in here?" Smythe shook his head. I took that to mean no Special Forces soldier would think that way. "To hit that base against Kristang, maybe against 6 sets of powered armor, we need numbers. 2 people will be up front driving and navigating. We can fit 20 passengers back here. Rig up extra seats. I figure we'll be driving through the nights until this thing runs out of power. Another 2 people, we can rig up seats in the cargo bay. We won't be bringing enough gear along to fill it. There's a cargo rack on the roof. We can set up a tent or some kind of awning up there for protection against bad weather. We can fit another 4 people. That gives us 28. In this terrain, we won't be driving fast. We might be able to have more guys running alongside it in shifts."
"No," I shook my head. "Last thing we need is somebody spraining an ankle along the way. I don't want any driving at night, either. Too risky."
28, huh? That evens the odds somewhat. The more people we bring, the more supplies we need to take with us.
That is a problem. We can look at some people going only part of the way as pack mules, carrying weapons, so people going into the fight only need to carry their weapons part of the way.
This is a logistics problem, sir. We need to think about this. Having an RV does solve a whole lot of problems.
Chapter 20.
Having an RV helped. We still needed to carefully plan the logistics, and it wasn't easy. Smythe had been working with Sims, and some problems remained. Serious problems.
"Sir, even with the RV getting us most of the way there, we still have the problem that we can't carry enough food both to get us to the scavenger base and back here."
"No," I said. "But we can lessen the problem if we only need food enough to get there," I explained. "And we don't plan to come back."
"Sir?"
"After the assault, we're not walking all the way back here. There's no point. And if that Kristang ship shows up early while we're walking out in the open, we'll be totally exposed. And what we're going to do is, after the attack, we hole up here." I zoomed the map out and scrolled to the west of the scavenger's base. "There are caverns here, in these hills. They're cramped, and it's going to be uncomfortable. This site is 70 kilometers west of the scavenger's base. We'll be closer to it on our way in. I think we may stop there and drop off any supplies we don't need for the assault, before we launch the attack." Smythe tapped his iPad, examining the caverns I'd mentioned.
"That could work. I've holed up in worse places, in the mountains of Afghanistan. We still won't have enough food. We won't be able to carry enough food to get to the scavenger's base if we're going to be hauling armor with us.
That will not be a problem, I said with a wink. I know a place that delivers.
Tapping the transmit icon on my Z-phone, I called the Flying Dutchman.
Hey, is this Skippy's Pizzeria?
Okay, sure, I'll play along.
His voice changed to a stereotypical New York accent.
Yeah, this is Skippy's Pizza. What can I do you for?
Do you deliver?
It depends. You's got a coupon or something?
Seriously, Skippy, we need a delivery of food and medical supplies. The first aid stuff we brought from Earth, not the fancy nano gizmos that we don't know how to use.
I explained how we planned to get to the scavenger's base by driving the RV, then on foot.
And by food, I mean sludges, dehydrated. We need maximum nutrition and minimum weight and volume. Can you send a couple shipments down to us?
Ah, sure, no problem. It's not like I'm busy.
You moron, I'm building a freaking starship out of moon dust up here.
I know you're extremely busy. We can't carry enough food with us to reach the scavenger's base, not with all the weapons and gear we need for the assault. Can you put together something simple to drop supplies to us? It will have to be capable of a soft landing. Oh, and it has to stay out of sight of the Kristang here. We can't have them seeing a contrail coming in, or parachutes.
Simple? Something simple. To fly all the way across a star system, enter the atmosphere without leaving a contrail the Kristang could see, and land a package without damaging it.
Simple, he says.
Uh-huh, yeah. Can you do that?
We don't need the first shipment today. We'll need it probably a couple days, maybe a week, before we reach their base. I sent our timeline to you.
I'm supposed to drop everything I'm doing up here, Skippy complained, to design, test, and build a drone delivery system from nothing.
That's kind of important, Skippy. Unless, you know, you don't want us to recover that AI for you. Or you have a better idea.
Damn it. I've been trying to think of a better idea while you've been blabbering on, and no, I don't have a better idea.
Crap.
All right, fine. Yes, I can put something together to deliver supplies to you. Maybe I'll get lucky and it will land on your stupid monkey head.
Excellent. Knew I could count on you, Skippy. All I can say is there better be a huge freaking tip for this delivery.
Yep. I decided to push my luck. If the delivery is late, do we get it for free?
With the food situation temporarily solved by Skippy's Pizzeria, we turned our attention to other logistical issues.
Captain Smythe, I said, I need you to plan the route from here to the scavenger base, especially the route for driving the RV.
Skippy already mapped out the fastest route. He tapped his iPad and the screen showed Skippy's suggested route. Also, two alternatives. Two more lines appeared on the screen. One slightly shorter and one that stretches out the caravan's power to get us the furthest before we have to get out and walk.
Being British, he called our salvaged vehicle a caravan instead of the American term RV.
Smythe, I said, I'm sure Skippy has mapped out mathematically perfect routes, and we can't hope to improve on that. However, I know that little shithead beer can, and one variable he won't include in the billions of calculations he ran is anything practical. Fastest, shortest, and, stretchiest are all fine in theory. But what we need is the route that gets us to the scavenger base by the target date with the least risk. For example, on this route here, I tapped the shortest line. Skippy's plan takes us straight through this big swamp. Sure, the RV can supposedly crawl or swim through a swamp. And what happens if a tread gets stuck, or a pontoon gets punctured, or a motor burns out and the RV is stuck in a swamp? Then we might have to walk out of the swamp, carrying all our gear and freezing cold water over our heads. And we can't take that risk. Skippy won't take that sort of possibility into account. He also won't consider that we're inexperienced drivers, so he may plan a route that takes us along a narrow cliff.
Got it?
Yes, sir, Smythe said, looking chastened. Wow, for the first time, I felt like a real officer.
Smythe called me over the next morning. He pinged me while I was helping Sims load supplies into the RV. I took a welcome break and went into the cavern to where Smythe was working in a tent, a heated tent. It felt good to step inside and unzip my jacket.
What do you have, Captain? I asked.
Several possible routes for us to reach the scavenger's base within 30 days with minimal risk, we think.
He pulled up the first of three routes on his iPad and explained how the route avoided as much as possible swamps, driving across mushy ice fields and steep terrain where the RV might slide down or tip over. After we cross this river, we should have enough power left to get here. These grasslands are relatively flat and dry. We'll have to walk from there. The good news is we'll only need to detour 40 kilometers to go around this swamp, and once we're past that, it's a straight shot and... Well, Bob's your uncle, we're there. Bob's my uncle. Neither of my three uncles was named Bob. Smythe chuckled.
It's an expression, sir. It means it's easy.
Oh. Bob's your uncle, huh?
Yes, sir.
Show me the other alternatives. He did. Each of the three possible routes had advantages. The first didn't get as far before the RV ran out of power. Its advantage is the walking part was over easy terrain. The second route stretched out the RV's power cells to cover the maximum distance, minimizing the distance we would have to walk. However, the walking route went through a region of hills and one swampy area. And the third route took the absolutely safest path for the RV, minimizing the possibility it would get stuck somewhere, and the walk would be through relatively flat, easy terrain. The disadvantage was the walking section of the route was the longest of the three alternatives.
All the routes require we cross these three rivers?
Yes, there's no way around them, literally, Smythe explained. We mapped the easiest crossings we can get to along the route, where the river current is slowest. Here, for example. He pointed to the first river crossing, which was the same on all three alternatives. The three routes diverged after that. If we cross up here instead, the river is only half as wide. However, your chap Skippy tells me the current is more than twice as fast in this area, and there are large rocks just under the surface. Down here, where we plan to cross, the current is more manageable, and the river bottom is sand. There are no underwater obstacles the caravan could get stuck on.
I nodded.
Makes sense. Good work. The sticky point is that last river. This nasty bugger here. He tapped the iPad screen for emphasis. It's going to be a problem. The glacier that feeds this river is breaking up quickly. There are large chunks of ice floating in the river. We'll need to steer around them. The river channel is narrow almost the whole way down to the sea. It would be hundreds of kilometers out of our way to find an easier crossing. And the riverbanks are steep. The only place we can see for a crossing is here. The bank on the far side is less than half a meter tall. Skippy tells us the caravan treads can climb that easily. And by the time we get there, with the summer coming on, the river level should be higher as the glacier melt accelerates. The bank is steep on this side. We'll need to create a ramp down into it. Lots of work with picks and shovels. Nothing the lads can't handle. He made it sound easy. Maybe the spec ops types hacking out a ramp large enough for an RV to drive down was a fun couple hours in the great outdoors. Right then I had an idea. Captain, we can use armor to clear a ramp. With those suits, it won't take long at all.
Do we want to use the suits for this, sir?
We'd need to recharge the suits' power cells from the caravan. That will drain the caravan faster. Not such a good idea after all. I was still thinking of what was now the good old days, when we had nearly unlimited power from the Dutchman's reactors. That mindset needed to change fast, before I made a stupid mistake and got people killed.
You're right. Saw muscles are a problem we can deal with more easily than draining power from the RV. We need to be very careful with the RV's power cells.
Route 2, I think, is out. I don't want us walking through those hills. The extra gravity, the low oxygen level, and the heavy loads we'll be carrying will make the hike tough enough already. Route 3, you say, is the least risk for the RV, but the walk is longer.
How much longer?
An additional 60 kilometers. Roughly a day and a half, sir. He didn't point out that information was clearly displayed on the side of the map. I should have noticed that. 60 kilometers was to Captain Smythe of the British Special Air Services a trek of a mere day and a half. He was assuming we would be walking 40 kilometers or 27 miles per day. Walking 27 miles each day with heavily overloaded packs and gravity 14% greater than we were used to on Earth.
60 clicks in a day and a half?
You're not being a bit too ambitious, Captain?
No, sir. Don't worry, sir. The lads can handle it. We'll check in every 2 hours, and you can track our progress through the satellite. I'll be tracking your progress closer than that, Captain. I'm going with you.
Sir? He asked, surprised.
I know I'm not one of you spec ops people, but I can handle a walk. There may be crucial decisions to be made real time when we raid the scavenger's base. I need to be there. Right there.
Smythe avoided my eyes.
Sir, why else do you think I've been busting my ass training with you?
I'm going along. But don't worry. I'll stay out of your way during the assault.
We're also bringing two civilians with us. Doctors. Medical doctors.
Sir?
Smythe's face revealed his anguish. Three of his precious 28 billets would be taken up by non-combatants. That reduced his striking power to only 25. It was bad enough that I would be going with them. Smythe having to deal with his commanding officer looking over his shoulder and second-guessing him in real time. At least I was a soldier and had been in combat, including killing a Krestang warrior with my bare hands, or at least with the butt of a rifle. Bringing two civilians along would be nothing but a headache for him.
We have qualified medics.
His roster of 28 Spec Ops troops included 4 people with medical certification in addition to the battlefield first aid training that all Special Forces soldiers had taken.
Qualified medics, yes. These 2 doctors are experienced surgeons. They both did a tour with Doctors Without Borders. They've operated in primitive field conditions.
This is not open for discussion, Captain. I'm not going into combat against Krestang without means to keep wounded people alive until we can get them back to the Theranan medical facility aboard the Dutchman.
Yes, sir, he said tightly.
I could tell he thought I was endangering the primary mission, assaulting the Krestang, in favor of a dubious secondary objective. In combat against Krestang, both sides having equivalent technology, wounds were very likely to be fatal. Any medical assistance might well be a useless waste of resources.
It may have been my lack of experience as a senior commander that caused me to bring 2 civilians along.
A real colonel may have looked at the problem more objectively, been more coldly calculating about the lives of his soldiers. That wasn't me. Also, I figured that if needed, I could fight, and if 2 less soldiers were the difference between success and failure, then this entire mission was far too much risk, and I should call the whole thing off right now.
The 2 doctors, Zheng and Tanaka, have been running and marching with us. You've met them.
Smythe gave a curt nod, unconvinced. What he didn't say was that going out for a run or a long march was one thing, knowing a warm, dry cavern with a meal and hot chocolate was waiting for him at the end of the exercise. Being out in the field, one day after the next, marching with a heavy pack in the chilly rain with only maybe a tent roof as comfort at the end of a long day, it was a very different test of human endurance. Mental endurance. A civilian who had not actually experienced such bone weariness for days on end could not say with certainty they could stand up to such strain.
He was right. I was taking a gamble that our 2 civilian scientist doctors could keep up with us. The Spec Ops troops and me would be carrying food, clothing, part of a tent and other personal gear, in addition to weapons and parts of disassembled armor suits. The 2 civilians would only need to carry food, personal gear, and medical kits. One way or another, they would be keeping up with us. We weren't leaving anyone behind unless injury absolutely forced us to do that.
That leaves 25 billets for combat troops, he mused.
And 5 nationalities. Choose 5 people from each nation, I ordered. We can't have anyone thinking we're playing favorites.
Oh my God! I was stunned. There. Attached to the front of the RV, just below the left windshield in front of the driver, was a stuffed Barney, about a foot tall.
Sir, Captain Gomez, the leader of our ranger team, said, I categorically deny any and all knowledge of this outrageous act. That is, unless you like it.
Like it? I love it.
Damn. Reminds me of my old Ham V back on Paradise. I'll ask you the same question I asked then. How the hell did you idiots get a Barney?
Gomez coughed.
Someone may have listened to your debriefing, and you may have mentioned your personal Ham-V then. And that same someone may like to be prepared. I'm speculating, of course.
Of course. I stood back and admired it, then turned to the assembled team, my team, and saluted.
Thank you. This means a lot. I used to hate that Barney shit. Now, it's part of me, I guess.
Gomez smiled.
Instead of a Winnebago, this is our Barney Wego.
Barney Wego, I laughed. I like it. Captain, let's get this thing loaded and on the road. ASAP. Oh, man. I should have put some thought into what a road trip in a stolen RV across an alien landscape with a crew of high-speed spec ops people would be like. A Barney Wego lurched into movement. Everyone inside gave a hearty cheer and waved to the assembled crowd outside, and we were off. When we splashed across the stream and the canyon veered to the right, so we went out of sight of the cavern that had been our home, Smythe broke out into song. Pumping his fist in the air to encourage participation, he sang, "The wheels on the bus go round and round." I joined in. It was fun. It built a sense of camaraderie. It set a good tone for the beginning of what was going to be a long, arduous journey. However, when the first song was done, the Indian team, who likely had been trying to think of a song most people in the RV knew or was simple enough to learn quickly, launched into 99 bottles of beer on the wall. And that was fun. For a while. Let me tell you, Spec Ops people are hyper-competitive. None of them wanted to stop it. The singing went on, to where we got down to 73 bottles of beer on the wall, and I, for one, was heartily sick of it. Of course, none of the Spec Ops people wanted to be the first to stop. They were way too damn competitive. The responsibility fell to me as the commander to mercifully kill the singing. "Stop. Quiet. What was that?" I stood up and walked behind the driver, using as an excuse a clanging sound against the bottom of the RV.
Sir, we're kicking up rocks here," the driver explained,
pointing out the windshield to the layer of rocks in the stream bed we were following down the canyon. There was another soft clang noise as the forward treads caught another stone and tossed it against the bottom of the RV. The plating of the Barney Wego was thicker on the bottom to protect against impacts. It also had kind of a skid plate for when the RV needed to slide over an obstacle. I called a brief halt and ducked outside to check the RV skin, partly out of genuine concern. There were some new scuff marks, no additional dents, nothing to worry about. When I got back inside, I was relieved to see people had broken out decks of cards and two games were getting started. Card games, even having nothing to gamble with except small pieces of candy people had smuggled in their personal gear, would keep people occupied. Occupied was good. The driver, a Chinese soldier named Zhang, put on some pop music, the rule being whoever was driving controlled the music selection. I couldn't understand the words, and remarked that pop music all over Earth sounded pretty much the same, so it didn't matter that I couldn't understand the lyrics. Captain Lee shrugged.
"That song is Korean, sir. K-pop, we call it. We don't understand the words either."
Damn, what an interesting international crew we had aboard our Barney Wego, bouncing and lurching our way across the surface of an alien world almost 2,000 light-years from home. It made me feel proud. Our first stream crossing was uneventful. Before the RV drove down the bank into the water, I ordered a halt and for everyone to get out so Skippy could drive the RV across remotely. The middle of the stream was just deep enough that the RV needed to deploy its flotation pontoons. They worked perfectly. The RV got to the other side, Skippy turned it around and drove it back to us. Then, half of us got back aboard, and our Chinese driver carefully took us across. He reported the transition between the RV driving on its treads to floating and using water jets was seamless. The RV's computer knew what to do, based on the driver's inputs to the controls. Captain Giraud drove the RV back to get the rest of us. Then we proceeded with an Indian soldier driving. That way, we now had three people with some experience. Damn good thing, too, because we had to cross our first major river in 2 days. After a couple hours, we stopped at a convenient place to switch drivers. Captain Smythe saw me looking longingly at the driver's seat.
"Would you like to have a go at it, sir?" he asked.
"Captain, I would love to drive this thing. I am not going to be some shithead officer who takes fun away from the troops. We'll be driving this RV for days. I can wait my turn." My policy that whoever was driving picked the music, or no music at all, led to an, let's say, interesting variety of musical styles. The first driver, a guy named Zhang, had played pop music I didn't recognize. It was at least recognizably pop. The second time a Chinese came up in the driver rotation, it was a guy named Chen. The music he played sounded like a cross between wind chimes, the kind of new-agey thing I expected people listen to at a yoga spa, and someone unsuccessfully trying to tune a guitar. After a while, I looked at Captain Lee, who shrugged, rolled his eyes, and we put headphones on to listen to our own music selections. Following Chen, it was the turn of an Indian paratrooper named Sharma, who liked to sing, loudly and badly, along with his music. His fellow paratroopers often joined in, off-key, but with enthusiasm. When one of our SEALs named Garcia started driving, it was across a relatively flat field, when the treads automatically adjusted themselves to be almost round, and we were making good time. The treads soaked up a surprising amount of bumps, so the jostling and bouncing in the cabin was a lot less than I'd expected. Garcia must have been feeling good, rolling happily along across an alien landscape in our stolen RV, because he changed his music selection in the middle of a song to go old, old school with Coolio. When the first notes of the song came over the speakers, the Chinese soldiers looked at each other and muttered something, and the Indian soldiers looked at each other and muttered something, and for a split second I feared we were going to have a problem. Then, the Indians, Chinese, and French all stood up, mockingly flashed gang signs, and sang along. Badly, with enthusiasm. As I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I look at my life and realize there's nothing left. Holy shit, I said under my breath. Does everybody know that song? Then Captain Smythe got up to join in, and soon everyone in the RV was going, "They've been spending most their lives living in the gangster's paradise." High fives went all around when the song ended. Damn, I thought, we really are one badass international team. Hopefully we could bring that cooperative team spirit back to Earth one day. The night after we stopped driving, the sky was cloudy but not raining. The wind had slowed to a gentle breeze, and for an early summer evening on Newark, it wasn't too cold. Smythe and I surprised the group by unrolling a screen and attaching it to the side of the RV so we could have movie night. Captain Chander of the Indian team provided a Bollywood hit movie. The Indians had all seen it before. The film was new to the rest of us. With our Z-phone earpieces translating for us, we were all able to understand the words without annoying subtitles. It was a pretty good movie, involving car chases, a forbidden love affair, gangsters, and something about diamond smuggling. Toward the end, I lost track of the complicated plot because I was so tired. The thing that made me sit up and take notice was that in the middle of a big fight scene, the characters all stopped fighting to break into an elaborate, choreographed song and dance routine. Minutes later, the music ended and they all went back to beating the crap out of each other. Gomez of the Ranger team expressed himself on behalf of most of us. When the fighting on the screen resumed, he shook his head as if he couldn't believe his eyes and said aloud, "What in the hell just happened?" The Indians all grinned and laughed, and Smythe responded with dry British humor, "Well, I suppose that's not any more strange than a Hollywood film where a car turns into a flying robot, isn't it?" Chapter 21. The first major river crossing was no big deal. We stopped at the riverbank to check out the best spot to get the RV down into the river. More importantly, the best spot for it to climb out on the far shore. The amount of dirt we had to move to create a ramp down into the water was a lot less than I'd feared. We had the job done in less than 2 hours. Next, I had one person drive the RV across and then back by herself. The driver for that shift was a Chinese named Liu, one of only 3 female spec ops soldiers with us. She drove the RV into the water. It slipped in the mud and made a big splash, wobbled a bit, then steadied and motored easily across. Lou reported the spot we'd chosen to climb out on the far bank was crumbly. I told her to use her judgment, and she selected a place upstream. The RV's treads powered it out of the water, and we could see Lou pumping her fist triumphantly in the front window. She came back across, loaded us aboard, and we went boating again. During the day, while we sat in or on top of the RV, there wasn't much to do except for the driver and the person acting as navigator. Smythe had everyone bring up maps of the scavenger base on their tablets, and together the spec ops teams created and rehearsed assault plans for a wide variety of contingencies. Most of our plans to hit the base depended on speed, surprise, and the cover and confusion of darkness. If we had to, we could attack during the day. That was not optimal. Thanks to the Krisang troop ship in Earth orbit, we had excellent night vision equipment. Our night vision gear looked like regular goggles, the kind you would use for skiing or riding a dirt bike or around power tools. Ordinarily, the goggles were clear and they worked like any plastic safety goggles on Earth, except these could stop a rifle bullet, and they repelled water, dust, and dirt using magnets or force fields or some super high-tech thing like that. Press a button on the left side of the goggles, and the inside of the lenses displayed whatever image you commanded from your Z-phone. You could select a night vision mode that displayed an enhanced view from the tiny cameras at each corner of the goggles, or you could pull up a map, data, or the view from someone else's goggles. That feature was very helpful to leaders. They could see what their troops were seeing in real time. You could even split the view, one side displaying a night vision image of what was in front of you, overlaid with a map, the other side displaying what some other soldier was seeing. It took some getting used to, and of course we had to stop treating it as a toy and learn how best to use different features depending on the situation. Until we gained more experience and proficiency, the simple night vision feature was best for most soldiers. Unlike the U.S. Army night vision gear I was used to, which restricted your peripheral vision and displayed a fuzzy, false-color image, the Cristang goggles showed you a view similar to twilight. The colors were muted, otherwise it simply appeared less bright than usual. Doing imaginary dry runs on a tablet screen had only limited usefulness. Each night after we stopped and set up camp, Smythe created a small-scale model of the scavenger camp, using backpacks for buildings and rope for fencing. Smythe spent an hour every evening, rain or shine, but mostly rain, explaining assault plans under various scenarios. Using a small 3D model with everyone standing around it did help. Still, Smythe regretted that we didn't have the time to build a full-size model of the scavenger camp so the team could practice for real instead of imagining. Creating a fake scavenger camp hadn't been possible before we shot down their two aircraft. We couldn't risk the Cristang seeing a fake camp from the air. And before we set out in the RV, we hadn't known how fast we could travel. Now, Smythe thought we should have taken a couple of days, even a week, to practice assaults before we set out in the RV. 2 days after crossing the first river, we were driving through a series of hills that stretched across our path. When planning the trip, these hills were a major concern. They turned out to be not a problem at all. The RV's treads automatically adjusted to the terrain, and we made good time. All the driver needed to do was watch out for huge boulders that were strewn all over the area. The science team, back at base and watching our progress through satellite images, thought that these boulders had been left there by a glacier. A glacier that had covered the entire area, perhaps a kilometer thick, after Newark had been pushed out of its original orbit. As Newark's orbit changed and the planet warmed up again, the retreating glacier had dumped rocks it picked up on its journey to the south. The hills we drove over, a series of parallel ridges, were a terminal moraine, according to our science team. Basically, each ridge was where a glacier had stopped and dumped all dirt, rocks, and other junk it had accumulated while it was expanding. We came over a hill. The next hill was a kilometer ahead of us, with a nice, flat area in between. It was late afternoon. I was looking at the map, trying to find a good place to stop for the night. While the sun had been popping in and out of clouds all day, we would be getting a steady rain overnight into the next afternoon. I looked up from the map to gaze out the windshield, and the flat, open valley in front of us caught my eye. I grunted. On my iPad, I zoomed in the satellite image. Other than some rocks sticking out the ground, this area between hills was pretty much flat and free of major obstacles. "Captain Smythe," I said, "this area in front of us, what do you think?" He clearly didn't know what I was referring to.
"This area reminds me a bit of the Yorkshire Dales, sir, if..."
"No, I mean, here, look at this." I showed him the satellite image of the valley, over which I had pulled up an outline of the scavenger base.
"Interesting," Smythe said, glancing from my iPad screen to the actual terrain in front of us. "We are ahead of schedule," he pointedly added.
"That's what I'm thinking," I agreed. "We can call a halt here, set up a full-size replica of the scavenger base while we have light, and practice the assault tonight. It's going to rain tonight," I added.
"Excellent," Smythe grinned approvingly. "Because it will most likely be raining during the actual assault."
Within an hour after the RV stopped, we not only had camp set up, we also had the fake scavenger base buildings and fences outlined with stakes and rope. Skippy inspected the layout through satellite images and gave Smythe grudging approval that the outlines were pretty darned accurate, within a couple inches in most cases. The rain that night ranged from steady to short downpours to a chilly, foggy mist, and it made an intense and exhausting night completely miserable for everyone. Other than me and the two civilian doctors, everyone thoroughly enjoyed themselves. I'd never seen dead-tired people looking so happy when we halted the exercises just after the sun rose. Smythe had his team run one scenario after another, again and again and again and again, until each assault plan was executed as flawlessly as possible. The people having the most fun were the Alpha teams in Kristang armored suits. They were able to practice jumping from the ground to the top of the RV and back down, and racing at full speed, leaping over rocks and generally showing off. I observed the exercises. I did not participate. I'm not a Special Forces soldier. I hadn't gone through combat training with them. I didn't know their tactics. I didn't know them as well as they knew each other. If I had insisted on participating in the assault, I would only get in the way, and maybe get someone killed. Observing was enough. The Alpha teams were, of course, awe-inspiring. Although after watching them sprint 70 miles an hour and leap 30 feet high, it became somewhat less impressive, because I expected awesomeness from such advanced alien technology. What truly impressed me were the Spec Ops soldiers without fancy armored suits. Fast, silent, well-coordinated, they converged on their assigned targets from multiple directions. Because Skippy knew the interior layouts of buildings at the scavenger base, we were able to use rope to outline hallways, doors, and walls so the teams could practice breaching doors and clearing a building room by room. Making things simple for the team was the fact that we were not trying to capture prisoners. We didn't need to be concerned about damaging anything, except for the two items we needed to secure, the AI and the comm node. In other buildings, we could sweep rooms with rifle fire or use grenades. Wherever the AI and comm node were stored, we needed to be careful. We could not risk hitting either of the Elder artifacts with bullets or explosives. Skippy reported that there were a few Elder artifacts stored in the building where the scavenger leaders lived, items the scavengers thought were the most valuable. To us, those items were useless junk, and Skippy didn't care if we blew them up. The AI and the comm node were inside a secure building the scavengers used as an armory. It was behind an electric fence with heavy double doors that only the leaders had access to. If the AI and comm node were inside the armory when we launched the assault, our task was easy. Secure the armory building, eliminate the Kristang, then we could retrieve the precious items later. If, for some reason, the two items had been removed from the armory, or even were separated, then the assault team's task was exponentially more difficult. And whatever we did, we couldn't let the scavengers learn that the purpose of our attack was to steal two Elder artifacts, or they could threaten to destroy them and stall our attack. Smythe had plans for multiple assault scenarios. That was all great, and the team practiced multiple options until they executed each plan like clockwork. What Smythe could not plan for was the unknowns. Technically, we did have plans for the unknowns we could anticipate. The weather, where in the base the scavengers would be sleeping, how many leaders and laborers were awake, what weapons the leaders had with them. Skippy reported that the scavengers did not have any set schedule for base security. Some nights, two or more leaders remained on watch throughout the night. Most nights, the leaders snoozed peacefully all night, relying on their electronic monitoring systems to alert them to any trouble. In one way, the scavenger base was an easy target for a surprise attack. The scavengers had plenty of weapons, including four functioning powered armor suits. In addition to standard Kristang rifles, the armory held heavy weapons, grenades, anti-armor rockets, and zingers. What mattered to our planning was that except for the suits and rifles the leaders kept with them in their secure compound, all the weapons were locked up inside the armory building. On a planet with no native threats, the leaders were mostly concerned about being threatened by their own workforce. That made it easy for us. We needed to be concerned primarily with taking out the leaders. Most of Smythe's plans assumed the leaders would be inside their compound at night. During nights, the laborers were locked inside their own compound, unable to get out. The exterior doors of buildings in the laborers' compound were locked at night, and electric fences crisscrossed the base, protecting the leaders from the laborers and keeping the laborers away from the armory. Once we took out the leaders, we could deal with the laborers later. That was the plan. What we couldn't plan for was the unknowns we couldn't anticipate. For that, we needed flexibility and individual initiative. Fortunately, Spec Ops soldiers excelled at those qualities. I needed to trust that whatever happened, the team could handle it. Our two doctors had peacefully slept through the night in the RV with earplugs and white noise playing on the radio. When it got to be an hour before sunrise, I roused them, and the three of us got a hot breakfast ready for the troops. The breakfast was much appreciated. After we struck camp and removed all traces of the practice area, we resumed traveling toward the scavenger camp, with the two doctors taking turns driving and me navigating. After six mostly solid hours of sleep, the team was fully refreshed, and it was my turn to sleep. I put in earplugs, strapped myself into a seat with a baseball cap down across my face, and the lurching and bouncing of the RV quickly had me soundly asleep. Hopefully I didn't snore. "Stop here," I ordered a couple days later. Smythe got out of the RV with me. We walked forward to inspect the slope ahead of the RV. It was not an ideal situation. The whole area was crisscrossed by canyons, most with sides far too steep to attempt driving the RV up or down them. There was only one possible route we saw from the satellite data. It looked a lot more drivable from the satellite when we were planning the trip than now when we were there on the ground. The plan was for us to drive northwest along a relatively wide, shallow canyon until we came to a side canyon. That one was almost like a road that led gently up to the plateau where we wanted to be. The main canyon had a stream running through it. The stream occupied the center bottom of the canyon's shallow V-shape. So did a lot of rocks that had tumbled down over the years. It had looked from the satellite that we could drive partway up on the right side of the canyon wall, avoiding the big rocks at the bottom. The canyon was broad and shallow enough that the side walls sloped gently until they reached the lip of the plateau above us. "This could be a problem," I mused, looking at the terrain the RV needed to drive over. Avoiding rocks did not appear to be a problem. They were as widely spaced on the canyon wall as they'd appeared on the satellite images. The problem was that in places, the side slope of the canyon wall was steeper than we expected. A few sites were almost 45 degrees. Smythe and I walked forward with the Spec Ops team leaders and our most experienced drivers. We walked over a mile and a half from the RV.
"If we can keep to this line,"
Williams drew an imaginary line on a shallow diagonal across the slope,
"we should be all right. We'll get up there."
He pointed to a spot up the canyon wall higher than we wanted to go.
"Hang an easy left and drive back down."
"Except for those two ridges."
Smythe pointed back to where the side slope of the canyon wall was steep.
"If we had time and equipment, we could hack out a road. The first one is only 100 meters, maybe, but the second one must be half a kilometer. We don't have the time, equipment, or manpower."
He pulled out his Z-phone and looked at the satellite image of the area, comparing it to what we were seeing on the ground.
"This may not be as bad as it appears from here. Do you ski, Colonel?"
"Snowboard some.
My family is more into snowmobiles. Our part of Maine is fairly flat, and it's a long drive to go snowboarding."
Smythe nodded.
"You know how, when you're at the bottom of a mountain looking up at the slope, it doesn't appear to be very steep, and you're confident you can get down it. Then you get off the lift at the top, and sometimes, suddenly, that same slope looks like it goes straight down. Maybe this is like a ski mountain. Maybe it looks more difficult from up here."
"Skippy," I called, "what do you think? Can you drive the RV past those obstacles, or will it flip over on its side?"
"What am I, an off-road racer?" Skippy asked. "Yes, it is possible for the RV to drive on a slide slope even steeper than those two areas. The treads have a limited self-leveling function, where the tread on the lower side will extend down to negate the slope. You can also shift cargo inside the RV so the weight is on the uphill side. However, I should not be driving. Even with the micro-wormhole facilitating communications, there is a time lag between me and the surface. I might not be able to react quickly enough. A human driver in the vehicle could feel the operation of the treads in real time and adjust accordingly. The problem is that the surface is soft and saturated with water. It could be somewhat unstable. I can't predict that. Someone is going to have to drive it for you, Joe. I suppose we're too far from Earth to call Uber."
"And it sure wasn't going to be me driving.
I had not taken a shift at the RV's controls. We walked back to the RV, making a very careful examination of the two problem areas along the way. Then we got everyone out of the RV, shifted cargo around inside and tied that down securely, and then Lieutenant Zhang took the controls and proceeded slowly forward. Everyone with driving experience had offered to take the RV over the obstacles. I didn't want to pick a favorite or do something silly like draw straws, so since Zhang had driven us into the canyon, he could drive us out. There were some hairy moments when we all thought the RV was going to tip over and the treads slipped wildly in the mud. Zhang remained calm. The treads stopped slipping and bit into the soft soil, and the RV slowly inched back into relatively flatter ground. When the treads on both sides returned almost to normal configuration, we all cheered. Zhang endured many backslaps as we climbed back into the RV. He gave me a thumbs up.
"Thank you for your faith in me, Colonel," he said.
"Would you like a break?" I asked, noticing that his hands shook slightly. He'd known that the success of the entire mission and the survival of humans on Newark had depended on him for a moment.
"Yes, Colonel," he admitted. "I've had enough driving for today, I think."
"Good job," I said as I gave him a gentle pat on the back and extracted from my pocket a piece of chocolate I'd been saving. "You deserve this." Zhang looked at that piece of chocolate, a precious enough item on Newark, but especially so on our current expedition, like I'd handed him a bar of gold. He accepted it in both hands, bowed slightly to me, and wrapped it carefully in a cloth before placing it in a pocket. The other Chinese soldier said something to him in Mandarin, and he broke into a grin. Apparently, I had just made his day. I was tempted to climb onto the roof and ride up there. The RV had a roof rack, and we'd rigged up a couple places to sit and an awning to keep rain off. As it was partly sunny that day, the awning had been taken down and stowed. The roof could be chilly. It was also a popular enough place to ride that I'd had to limit people to taking shifts up there. They changed when we changed drivers. Inside the RV was warm and dry, out of the wind. It was also dreary, as the RV had few windows. Realizing that if I went on the roof, someone would have to come down, I stayed in the RV, adjusting my seat so I could see out the front windows. One of our SEALs named Taylor took the wheel, as he had the next shift, and Lieutenant Williams stood behind the driver's seat.
"Right up there, by that big round rock. That's the top," Williams pointed out. "Make a straight line for it, and when we're over the crest, let it fall off to the left, and we'll get back down to our original course."
"Got it,"
Taylor replied. Adams went back to his seat, strapped in, and we headed off. All went well at first. Taylor carefully and confidently drove us up to the crest, let the RV naturally turn slightly to the left, and drove a fairly straight line toward a gap between two large rocks. Those two rocks, I remembered from the satellite images. We had planned our route to avoid them. Now that I saw them from the surface, they were not a big deal. The gap between them was 4 or 5 times wider than the RV, with some smaller stones half buried in the ground, the RV's treads morphed shaped to roll over the stones as if they weren't there. After shooting the gap, it was an easy drive back down to the original course we'd planned, parallel to the stream at the bottom of the canyon. Even at the careful rate that Taylor was driving, it would only take us a few minutes to get back down to the intended track, which at that part of the canyon was almost like a shelf notched into the shallow canyon wall. To my eyes, I wondered if the shelf had ever been a road, created millions of years ago by Newark's original inhabitants. That idea was stupid, I knew. No road could have lasted that long, especially not in a canyon carved by the advance and retreat of glaciers, glaciers massing millions of tons. The shelf, and the one on the opposite canyon wall, had been created by the stream in full flood, raging over its banks and carrying stones smashing and scouring the soil of the canyon walls, each year digging the canyon deeper and wider, carrying its soil eventually grain by grain down to the sea. It would take us only a few minutes to get down to the shelf notched into the canyon wall, even though Taylor was being extra careful driving in the soft, muddy soil. And then, suddenly, it didn't take any time at all.
"Whoa!"
Taylor shouted a warning from the driver's seat at the same time we all felt the RV rock side to side, then drop sickeningly. "What's wrong?" I shouted back, pushing myself up in the seat to see through the window in the front of Taylor. Taylor replied much more calmly than I could have managed.
"I didn't do anything.
The treads won't... Ah! As he gave the alarm, there was a high-pitched whine from the treads on the right side. The RV lurched to the left and dropped again, and then it rolled. The RV rolled to its left, rocked back to the right, then to the left again, and kept going. Out the driver's window, I saw someone jump off the roof. The RV was rolling over, and the people on the roof weren't waiting for an engraved invitation to get the hell off the thing. It was chaos.